Okay, I can hear myself, which is good. Hopefully the rest of you can hear me as well. First of all, thank you very much for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be able to speak to an audience about something that's been a part of my life since I was five. Education has been, central to my role, to the point where I had one year where I wasn't working or where I wasn't in a school, and summer rolls around and I'm thinking, oh, June 21st, I can quit work for a few. You can't do that when you're actually in the workforce. You don't take a two-month holiday in the summer. And it actually changes and shapes the way you do things when you're a teacher. So today I was asked to talk about whether or not it's enough to have a Reformed Christian school. And that stems, I think, from an article that I put together quite a few years ago, where I looked at, what does it really mean to have a Reformed Christian school? What are our responsibilities inside a Reformed Christian school? And so tonight I came back, I visited that again, and I'm just going to go through kind of the agenda for the evening, and then we're going to get into the thick of it. So we're going to talk for a little bit about the past, and I wasn't around at the beginning of John Calvin School, or I was a student when Acres began, and I'm not sure if there's other schools that are represented in the audience, but I only speak then on this one about kind of what I've picked up from talking to the founding members, some of the things that they've had. And we're going to talk about what the purpose is. What's your purpose in setting up a Reformed Christian school? And then we're going to move to the present, the situation that we find ourselves in right now. And then we're going to finish off with a little bit about the future, and then you can ask anything that you would like to, and I will only answer what I want to. Okay, and everything else I'll pass off to George. So, first of all, a little bit about the past. Here's a little bit of history. Schools don't start for no reason. I think that's something that we sometimes forget when we're into what's now the third generation of students. I'm not sure if there's any fourth generation students in the schools yet, but it's getting pretty close. I did a little bit of math, and I figured if you start school, like Winnie Boss, I only know the name because she told me many times that she was the first grade 8 class in John Calvin School, so if I used her as my sample. And I said, okay, so let's say that she has her first kid enter when she's 28. And then over the next 28 years, there's another, her grandchildren are in. Well, the next 28 years actually leads us to about 5 years from now when it's possible that she has great-grandchildren starting the school. So that's pretty incredible. In terms of the longevity of what we've done. And it started a long time ago with a group of people that felt that they had to do something. And so to begin with, then they set up a school. And this was something that they did for a number of reasons. One, it was a reaction. So from talking with the founding members, they said, it's a reaction to what we were seeing out there. What was it that we were sending our kids to various different schools? Some were sending to the Christian Reformed school, some were sending to the public school, and they were dissatisfied with both. So in a reaction to what they were able to use, they decided that they would start up their own. Now, this, of course, is one of the reasons, one of the possible reasons. It was also then a response. And this one may resonate even stronger with the founding generation, but also resonates, I think, with us today. It's a response to the promises that you make at baptism that you're going to raise your children in the fear of the Lord to the best of your ability. And so one of the ways in which you do that is you set up an educational institution to help you with the academics of it. And so you begin your own school. And the other part, of course, was it's a challenge. And I actually firmly believe that one of the sole purposes, but one of the neat results of starting your own school is the experience of the challenge of starting your own school. Especially the challenge of starting your own school when you have very little in terms of financial means. For us young folk who are in the schools now paying, you know, between 600 and 700, some schools 900 a month, the idea of saving 25 cents a week seems a little ridiculous. But I know for sure that in the Burlington schools, when they first started their society, which is long before they began their school, that's what they were saving, and it was hard, and they couldn't convince everybody to do it. There's a lot of money. When you're only making a few dollars a week to save, that becomes a percentage of 5% a week that you have to be very careful with. And so, and yet they did it. And I have to believe by talking with those members that they loved the challenge of it. Because once it became a reality, then they can see the blessing of the Lord also in their lives. But a lot of years have passed. And the schools, especially in this area, have been well established now for quite a while. And so we have to ask, okay, so why do we have them? Do we still have them for those same reasons? And now we come to the sticky note that's on your sheet of paper. What I'd like you to do with that sticky note is, if you have a pen, of course this is a prerequisite, you could write it in blood if you'd like, but I don't recommend it. If you have a pen, I want you to write down what you think is the main purpose of a Reformed Christian school. You got 30 seconds. I do have a pen? Ah, I have one pen that we can pass around. Does anybody need one? Thanks. Anyone else desperate need of a pen? Of course, if you don't have a pen, you can't do anything. What do you think is the main purpose of... One second. Okay. You're there just about? Okay, I want you to take that sticky note. I want you to fold it in half so the two sides stick together. And I would like you to pass this sticky note to someone you don't know very well, or perhaps somebody within relative reach, and exchange it. Then you're going to get up and you're going to move again. You're going to read it and you're going to exchange it with two more people. Okay, so take your sticky note, fold it in half, find somebody that's not your spouse, basically, and exchange it, but you're going to exchange it three times. So you're not going to have, you get it, you read it, you exchange again. You get it, you read it, you exchange again. You get it, you read it, and you exchange again. It's okay. Okay, so it looks like we've had our exchanges. Now, that means that you have somebody else's purpose in your hand. That's a responsibility. Because now I'm going to ask for 5 volunteers from the audience to share somebody else's purpose. So read what you have, and if you think that if it resonates with you or if it doesn't resonate with you, raise your hand so you can read it to the rest of us. And we're gonna take a sampling of 5, although there's lots of people here. Well, time for 5. So who's gonna start? All right, go ahead. If you, stand up so we can all hear it.
Okay. Help support us as parents to educate our children and instruct them in the ways of the Lord.
All right, excellent. Another one. You don't need a mic.
Be very quiet now.
Learn to live together as Christians.
Okay, another one. There's at least 50 out there. Even if it's a repetition. Yep.
Assist parents in the baptismal calling.
Okay, another one.
Okay. Oh boy. get my exercise today.
Yeah.
So that our children learn at school what is taught in the church and at home reinforces our responsibility to teach our children in the way of the Lord.
All right, another one. Preferably from that area so John doesn't walk so far.
Pardon?
Form kids to act to the glory of God in all aspects of life.
Okay. Was that five? I think so. So you'll see some similarities. You'll see some patterns when you ask parents, when you ask grandparents, what the purpose of a Reformed Christian school is. And I find it fascinating that when we talk about these things, we seem to skip down a level. I want to show you what I mean. You'll notice there, you probably can't see it from the back. Well, the battery you can, but the top piece there is a buck knife. Now, Buck Knives are a very famous knife company from the United States, very large. They produce millions of knives a year. And if you're a hunter, there's a buck knife that's got your name on it because apparently, though I'm not a hunter, they are one of the best knives out there. And the other is an Interstate battery. And the reason why I want to highlight these at this point is because, well, these are large companies from the States, and what they've done very well is stated their purpose. And so I'm going to this is probably the only reading I'm going to do this evening, but I want to read you first a statement from the Buck Knife Company, and then I'm going to read you a statement from the Interstate Battery Company. And what's interesting about the Buck Knife is, if you look up here, you'll see when you buy one, you get the box. See the shadow right there? You get a paper that says, be careful, don't cut your fingers off. You get a paper here that says, okay, this is how you care for it. And then you get a message from the chairman. And it's in every box with every buck knife out there. I want to read you that message. It's this. You are now a new buck knife owner. Welcome aboard. You're now part of a very large family. Although we're talking about a few million people, we still like to think of each other as users as a member of Buck Knives family. And we take a personal interest in the product that was bought. With normal use, you should never have to buy another. Sounds pretty normal for a knife company. But it doesn't stop there. Now that you're part of the family, now this comes with every Buck Knife sold. Now that you're part of the family, you might like to know a little bit about our organization. The fantastic growth of Buck Knives was no accident. From the beginning, management determined to make God the senior partner. In a crisis, the problem was turned over to him, and he hasn't failed to help us with the answer. Each product must reflect the integrity of management, including our senior partner, and senior is with a capital. If sometimes we fail on our end because we are human, we find it imperative to do our utmost to make it right. Of course, to us, besides being senior partner, he is our heavenly Father also. And it's a great blessing to us to have this security in these troubled times. If any of you are troubled or perplexed and looking for answers, may we invite you to look to him, for God loves you. And then it finishes with, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life, John 3, verse 16. And it's signed Al Buck. Every buck knife out there. What's the purpose of the company? Then we get to Interstate batteries. Anybody know if they have an Interstate battery in their car? Huge. I know. Anybody know how to open the hood of their car? We're all teachers. So Interstate batteries is a huge battery company. It's multinational. They sell batteries all over the world, and they have for a long, long time. And I came across this, by the way, I'm not I'm not dreaming all this stuff up. If you want a good board read, no, not a good boring read, but a good read about organizations and companies and how to keep them true, some of these ideas came from this book called Mission Drift by Peter Greer and Chris Horst. It's a phenomenal read in terms of, you know, what our purpose is and how we think. But I found Interstate Batteries kind of by accident. It was not one of those things that I was, you know, necessarily looking for. But I was researching Christian companies and looking at their statements and seeing kind of how their purposes are. And, you know, so what do? You Google. I Google Christian, you know, large Christian companies. I came up with Interstate Batteries as one of them. There was a few others that I found surprising. But Interstate Batteries, I went to. And I went to their website, and then you look at their history, and then you look at their purpose. And this to me, was shocking. When I read their purpose, and it was this: our purpose, to glorify God and enrich the lives as we deliver the most trustworthy source of power to the world. Their purpose is to glorify God as they do their business. They don't stop there. We fulfill our purpose by doing business based on biblical principles such as honesty, humility, service, and care in a way that is welcoming and loving to all. As a company contributor, you are free to interact with the purpose in whatever way is most meaningful to you. Our values, however, are unchanging, and we ask that our team members try their best to live them as they serve our key stakeholders. Team members, customers, distributors, franchisers, suppliers and vendors, communities and shareholders, by creating a welcoming and caring environment, we create the positive experience for our team members and everyone with whom Interstate touches, no matter their background or their belief system. And I was struck again by this clear statement of purpose. And it just so happened that I kind of stumbled upon this as I was preparing for this. And so I went to the schools, and those that have mission and vision statements that state their purpose, I looked for something similar, and it wasn't there. Now, I'm not faulting, because I think it wasn't there because it's an assumed reality. We do all for the glory of God. It's already there. And then what do we do? How do we do that? Well, that's where we're there to assist parents. But I thought it was quite something, because both these companies said that having that as their purpose changes their outlook on how they do business. And it would. If I run I could pick on somebody. I run a construction company, a large construction company, and on my purpose statement, on my website, it says that our construction company's purpose is to glorify God. How do you think that would affect the way that construction company does business? You can't get a higher standard. Everything you do reflects then how you glorify God. And I think that that's something that we can think about even in our schools. As we think about the purpose, if our purpose is to glorify our Heavenly Father, and that's our reason for existence, and we're upfront and we state it all the time, I think it will have an impact on all kinds of things. And that's going to kind of catch the main thrust of what we're going to talk. Knives and batteries. Of course, I forgot to change all these things out. We're going to move into this, our purpose. Now, He's not here. Some of you may have been involved in this. This is a newspaper from the 70s at some point in time. You can't see the people so well, but just so you know, Roland Vanandel is in this one. He's the little boy on the one side. This is the Ebenezer Christian School in Chatham when they first opened their doors. It was a public opening, a public ceremony where this Christian school began, and they were welcomed into Chatham. It's kind of interesting that they're welcomed into Chatham as the fifth school society in the town. And they were very honest about who they were for. They're there for the Canadian Reformed Church in Chatham. And they set up across the street from the public school in Chatham. And the purpose, having a purpose, I guess, that's overt and said we are here for the glory of God is a blessing. It's a blessing because it gives you that clear focus, that clear direction. But of course, it's also a challenge. It's a challenge because how do you live up to it? Every time you fail, and we do, that was also in that buck knife statement, every time you fail, it has a direct impact on the God you serve. It's not just the parents. It's not just the students. It's not just your fellow staff members. It's not the staff that's under you if you're bored. It has a direct impact. And so it's a real challenge for us as we, especially now, move our schools into this fourth generation of students, which means we're talking third generation of leaders. The third generation that doesn't necessarily think the same way as the first one. So a little bit about the present. In five words or less, it's on your sheets of paper. In five words or less, I want you to jot down what you think is the greatest strength of our schools. You don't have to get up for this one. So you can pretend to write something down if you want. I'm going to ask for a few responses. There it is. Okay. We don't need a mic for this one, John. I just want people to, since it's only five words, if you get a loud voice, you're confident, you want to talk about what you think is the strongest voice or strongest, largest strength in our schools, what do you see it is? What do you see it as?
A reformed worldview is taught.
A reformed worldview is taught. Something else? Yes.
We have a common purpose and vision with parents and teachers.
We have a common purpose with parents and teachers. One more. Yeah. This should have moved you all to the front. Go ahead.
I think our greatest strength is our faithful God.
Okay. Thank you. Spin that around. So we have our common purpose. We have the fact that we're together as a people. And of course, we have our God. The other side of it is what's our greatest weakness? Yes? Say again? The parents. I would never, ever dare to say that as a teacher. Like, ever. It actually makes me nervous to say that right now. What else? Anyone else? Greatest weakness? Our sin. And so what this tells me, and this is what I was expecting to hear. I was expecting to hear, of course, our greatest strength was the Lord, especially after the first bit. But the other thing I was expecting to hear is the fact that our greatest strength is the people. The community that we have is our greatest strength. And guess what our greatest weakness is? The community that we have. And that happens so often in life that the greatest strength in an organization is the same as its greatest weakness. And because of that, of course, we have to ask ourselves, is it enough to have a Reformed Christian school? And the answer to that has to be no. You can't just set it up and let it run. It's not enough to have it. You have to grow it. You have to nurture it. You have to work at it. And you have to know why you exist. And that your existence has to be based on something larger than the people that belong to it. So we're going to go through this fairly quickly. What does this mean for? So if it's not enough, if it's not enough to have it, what does this mean for our church community? Now, there's a couple of things here that I want to draw out. First things first, I want to make clear. Our Canadian Reformed churches, and it's different than in the URC churches in the tradition, but our Canadian Reformed churches have the tradition to start supporting the schools soon after you profess your faith. I think you say, "I do," at the beginning, and then as you're shaking hands in the back, members of the school board say, "Here's some envelopes for you." Your monthly fees are. And it's part of the culture. No one's surprised at it. It's always there. And it gives this sense that the church community is there to help raise children. It's almost like our Premier Kathleen Wynne once said, that it takes that village, the church, to raise a child. Now, she stole that from an African proverb. But that's not true, I think, is what I want to point out. The church community is a huge help for the Reformed Christian schools. But the church community doesn't support the Reformed Christian schools to raise your children, even to help you raise your children. Scripture never says that it's anyone's responsibility to raise your children except you as parents. You're the ones that are called to walk along the road. The parents are the ones that are called to do the raising. And so that when we talk about how our schools assist parents, the key word there is assist. And we have to be careful then that we also know what we're assisting with. Schools are not assisting, their primary purpose anyways, with character formation. The primary purpose of a school is not to assist with, making sure that kids know right from wrong. The primary responsibility for those most important things belong with parents. But that is something that our culture is losing. And it's something that comes into our communities too. Our schools in the public system, they're picking up every aspect of parenting out there. And the danger, of course, is that our schools follow suit. And so we have to be careful that we know what the purpose of the schools are. And that's to provide a spot where your children can learn academic skills in an environment that holds God as the highest authority and whose purpose is to glorify the Father. So what's the role of the church community? Well, they're there to help those parents. Why is baptism done at the front of the church? So that we can witness. Have you ever noticed that the form, I was going to read the form, but I don't have time, and I feel too much like Reverend Bauman. But if you go look at the pronouns in that form, it doesn't talk about you as parents, Will, but it talks about we and talks about us, and it's an inclusive form. So there's definitely a role for the congregation in terms of supporting parents to raise children. And I believe that's where the good tradition of supporting the schools, even if you were not a parent inside that school yet, ever, or you have been a parent but now you're finished. You don't lose that responsibility that you had to assist the parents. And what are you assisting the parents with? You're assisting the parents with raising their children in the fear of the Lord to the best of their ability. And for the parents that send their children to our schools, to our Reformed Christian schools, they say that in this aspect of education, the best of my ability is inside those walls. It doesn't make it exclusive. You don't hand over the raising of your children to people that didn't give birth to them. But you entrust that one aspect to them. And that's a huge trust. And that's why it's so important that the school where we send our children to is in line with what we hold to be true in our lives. Again, if you look at the form, look at the questions that you're asking. Do you believe that the Lord is your God? Yes, I do. So I want that in my home, I want that in my church, and I need that in my school. Do you believe the doctrine? Yes, I do. Do you promise to raise your children in the fear of the Lord? Yes, I do. And how do I do that? I do that with the church, and I've chosen to do that with the school. That has these huge implications, especially inside the school's leadership. Because if a whole group of people has said that my promise, my vow to the Lord that the congregation has accepted, the congregation has witnessed, and the congregation has promised in that sense to hold me to, that aspect of it, I'm going to give it over to a school. Then the leadership in that school, the board, has a massive responsibility to make sure that the best of that the parent's ability is fulfilled. That means that they do, and I'm not saying that they don't, they take their role very, very seriously. Because hundreds, thousands of children go through those walls. But they also do it with weakness because they're people. And we know that we don't always get it right. And we haven't always gotten it right. If I think back to stories I hear when what happened inside the classrooms when the school first started, and if you're in that age group, you know the stories, you've lived those stories. If I think about that, I think to myself, that couldn't have been the best of the parents' ability. It wasn't represented in the board, it wasn't represented in the school. But it also didn't remain. It shifted. It changed. As teachers got better, as board members got more experience, as the community grew, they became to understand what it looks like better. Now it's to the point where you have graduates of the school, thinking of John Calvin, in board roles. In fact, you have the children of graduates of the school in board roles. We're pretty good at that, you know. Schools, about $16 million a year in Ontario gets invested into our schools' budgets. Every year, $16 million. It's a big organization. And those boards, when they're there, they need to also work with their skill sets. They need to work with their game. And they have a role. And that role is maturing as they go along. From moving from a small business mentality where the board takes and does everything that's happening, right, where you're on the property committee, that means you're spending every Saturday night there at the school fixing things, You're on the transportation committee, so you're heavily invested in how the buses is running. You're in the education committee, so you're looking very closely at all these things. We've moved to the point where we're professional, and we've hired the people to do that work for us. And the board's role then is shifting, and I believe it should shift to a role where they direct the affairs of the school, they protect that purpose of the school, and then they make sure that those things are happening. And that's something that's pulled out. Another great read, if you are interested in it, is this one here. It's called The Imperfect Board Member. That's all of us, by the way. But the point of this is that a board's role, you need to know the levels. You need to know who's responsible for what. And what's interesting about our boards is everyone in the board is technically sitting in a conflict of interest. And the reason why I say that is because our board members are also our customers, if you think about school as a business. And what that means is that they don't just come with a direct, a protect and an inspect view. They also come at it from, okay, what's this going to cost me? And so every decision that has a financial implication is weighed against their own wallets. And I don't say that to belittle. I don't say that to disparage. I say that because it's true. It's the reality of what we built and what the Lord has allowed us to build. And boards are also very good at getting over that, because they're building the understanding that they're not there for their own glory, they're not there for their own pockets, but they're there for the glory of God. And so when things have to get done in order for the best efforts of the parents to be met, then they're more than willing to lead the way. And they need to continue to build that capacity. And then it's not just the board members that have to worry about that. You also have the staff. Now, as staff, as parents, let's talk about those parents. I have allowed my child to be in the presence of others for a good portion of their waking hours, from the age of 6, 5, to the age of 17. That means the people that I give that care to had better be good. When your school is there for the honor and glory of the Lord, and to serve the best of my ability as a parent to teach, I can expect, and I do expect, that the quality of the instruction is going to be top-notch to the best of the teacher's ability. And I think, in my experience, that our teachers get that. Our teachers understand that. And our teachers work for that. Do they do it perfectly? As perfectly as I parent, that's how they do it. But it also means that they have that responsibility. They have the responsibility to be professional, to be selfless, to be trustworthy, to be skilled, and to be disciplined in their own actions. Why? Because they're there for the glory of the Lord in a school. That's a huge, tall order. It also means, of course, that parents are there. And this is where I need to remember that as a parent, it is my job to raise my child. I allow teachers to work with them academically, and teachers put up with my children's tongues and personalities. But as a parent, I can't forget that it's my responsibility to raise my children. And so I can't expect the school to teach them to be kind. I can expect them to demand kindness. I can't expect the school to teach the character development that needs to come from me. The love for the Lord needs to come from me. It will also come from the school. But I need to be, as a parent, the primary educator of my children. And I do that in weakness. And I do that to God's glory. And it has implications then in terms of my expectations for the school and for the teachers and how I work with them. And then, of course, it has implications for the students. If your school's purpose is to glorify the Lord, that's something that you can take with you in the classroom. You can take with you on the bus. You can take with you at home when you're talking about the work that they don't want to do. I mean, really, Pythagorean theorem is wonderful stuff, but it's kind of boring. Right? As is the war of, all wars are interesting. I only say that because I've never been through one, so they're also horrible, terrible things. But the point is that as a student, you have to allow those expectations. You have to be, since the purpose of your school is to glorify the Lord, then you can call your students out as teachers. You can call your children out as your children to make sure that what they're doing is God-pleasing. Now, we do that anyway. But in the context of the school, we have to be able to do that more, I think. And then, just to wrap it up, because I'm probably close to time, John's got his watch out, I'm going to ask you a simple but difficult question. What did your great-grandfathers do for a living? I know this is like got nothing to do with anything you're thinking to yourself, but it's an honest question. Think back to your great-grandfathers. You should have four of them. Does anyone know what any of your great-grandfathers did for work? You're not allowed to say just farming. You have to tell me what kind of farming, by the way. Yes, you know?
My great-grandfather was a day laborer on a farm. In his spare time, he also worked for the fire department in town.
Okay.
There was a couple hundred in a small town because it all had to be done by hand.
What about the other three? I'll slow down. What about the other three?
The other three.
Great-grandfathers.
One was a blacksmith.
Amazing.
The other two, they were farmers. That's all I know. Okay. My mother's side were farmers.
Can anybody beat that?
No.
I can't either. And I've thought about this question for a while, more than just now. My great-grandfather, I only ever met one of them. What he did for a living, all I know is he was old. Absolutely. I understand that. The purpose of the question is this. We are now inside the time where the third generation is leading the schools. The fourth generation is going to the schools. That means the great-grandchildren of the founding fathers are going to our schools. Can we work with the expectation that they understand the purpose of the school as their great-grandparents set it up? We can't. Nor should we necessarily. Because the great-grandparents' needs are not the needs of the coming generation in some ways. But there is that greater purpose which crosses generations. And that's to have a school that glorifies the Lord as it supports the parents in the academic education of their children. And in order to keep that from generation to generation to generation, it needs to be articulated clearly. You can't work off the assumption that it's going to remain like this forever. And that's why you have companies like Buck Knives, fourth generation company, companies like Interstate Battery, third generation company, who have it written right in their purpose statement, we do this to glorify the Lord. And those companies can't change those statements. In one of the companies, not either of these two, but in another company, in order for them to change the purpose statement, which is to glorify the Lord, it has to be passed by three consecutive boards. So three boards in a row have to vote unanimously to change it. They've entrenched it in there. And that's also what we have to do as our schools. We have to know the purpose. We have to understand what we're here for. And then we need to entrench it. And we need to talk about it. We need to teach it. We need to follow the scriptural principle of talking about how we glorify the Lord in our schools as we walk along the roads. And we can do that and remain flexible enough to meet the needs of the coming generations. Needs that are different than the needs of the schools when they were serving a largely farmer population. Parents now are looking for different academics, if you will, than the parents that started the school. And it will be done differently. But we need to make sure that we protect the ultimate goal, which is to glorify the Lord. And that has all kinds of implications, including, who teaches, who sends, the role of the congregation, all those things. And I'll finish with this one, which is from the shorter catechism. And I'll thank Mr. Jack Huizenga for bringing this to mind on Monday. What's the chief end of man? Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Now that would be a wonderful purpose statement for a school. That's...
Thank you. I have a question for you.
My experience has been that talking about the purpose of our Reformed education, as you do here tonight, is not a communal effort. It goes very little on in our community. How do you bring that to the community? It's mostly teachers talking about it.
So you're saying when you look at the room, I'm largely preaching to everybody that already agreed with me before I started.
That could very well be. I don't know. I'm not saying that. But I do know as a community, we do not stress it enough.
Familiarity breeds contempt. I think that in a way you're right, that we don't speak about it enough. I also think it's because it's just there. Schools are there, they've always been there, and we feel that they will always be there. And so the expectation, why do you send your children to the school? Some people send their children to the school because, well, they're afraid of what will happen if they don't, meaning What are my parents going to say? What is the church going to say? I don't want to put up with that. Some people send their children to the school because they feel, you know what, this is excellent because they'll take care of the Bible stories, they'll take care of this. I need to work to pay for the school, so that's going to work. Some people send their children to the schools because they know the importance of that assistance with the academic work and the ability of children to interact in a place where the teachers believe the same things as I do as a parent. Some people send their children to the schools because they want to, or they can't do as good a job as they'd like to. And I think all we need to do then is, as a community, we need to talk up how the place where you send your children to school is a blessing in the lives of the children, as well as a blessing in the lives of your family. But in order for that to happen, the schools themselves need to continue to do that actively. And they can't rest. If I look at Reformed education and I think excellence, I think of those things as synonymous. I think it's if our purpose is to glorify the Lord, then when we build our schools and when we run our schools and we teach in our schools, it has to be the only option, not because that's the only place my children are going to get a boyfriend or a girlfriend that goes to the church, but it's the only option because it's just top-notch education. Not only is it God faithful, but they're on track with giving the students the academic excellence that they need to move forward. Right? I think when the schools continue to articulate that, continue to build on that capacity, then what the schools are for the community will grow. But we have to allow the parents of today's children to also articulate that for themselves. Anything else? I do have one text question, which I'll read. Is the purpose of our schools something that should be taught from the pulpits of our churches? Yes and no. That's easy. I start with a no. At least not primarily. I think that the purpose of our schools needs to be taught by the parents to their children from peer to peer, so that when young couples with children get together, they talk about the purpose of the school amongst themselves. To me, that is the most effective way of building a love for and a community in a school society. So we can't rely on the minister and say, you know, it's up to the minister, he has to preach it off the pulpit. And when he preaches it off the pulpit, we turn and we look and say, see, George? That's what I said. Right? And yet, I think because our communities have said as a community that we're going to set up a school that is denominational in nature, then I do think it's appropriate for the ministers to pray for and encourage the people from the congregation to send their children to a school that they know is faithful and glorifies God. So yes, a minister, it should be something that is openly discussed in home visits and off the pulpit. But the question needs to be asked, is where your children are being educated, is that the best of your ability in how you teach them to fear the Lord. And that's what the school, whether that's Acres or John Calvin or Heritage or Guido or Ebenezer Chatham, that's what they strive to do.
As part of the answer to what you gave, I'm just looking at the church order and Article 58. Yeah. Of course, it speaks very clearly that the consistory shall ensure that the parents, to the best of their ability, have their children attend a school where the instruction is given in the harmony with the Word of God. So definitely the church has a task there as well.
And by the way, that's been there since the Synod of Antwerp, 50 years before the Synod of Dort.
Yeah, and I also know, if you pull out your pew copies of Vanuna's book, that
Common Consent,
that's the one, I should know it. So Vanuna, if, for those of you who have, everybody's read with Common Consent, right? The book about the church order is fascinating read. If you've never read it, you really should pick it up. It's great for those sleepless nights. Now, he said that that article doesn't belong in the church order. But he didn't stop there, thankfully, because he said, while it doesn't belong, because it's not about church governance or church polity, he said it's a good article to have because we need to stress for our congregants that they need to send their children, they need to educate their children in a place where it's in line with their beliefs. He said, why would you send your child to a place that breaks down everything that you're trying to build up? Which is what a public school system would do. They'll systematically destroy everything that we try to do as a Christian family. So there's no excuse then for sending your child to the public school system. And you could, if you want to extrapolate that out into, you know, a interdenominational Christian school. But that's a longer topic, and that's, I think, that is something that we have to talk about compassionately and with understanding. So.
You mentioned several times.
Wait a minute.
The fourth generation going to the school.
Only helps if you
hold. Oh, well, they can hear me anyway. Don't worry. But the fourth generation is in September going to college. So not going to schools now, but they're going to college already. So,
right, they will be the leaders in a number of years. Right.
Yeah.
The preaching on the pulpit is not to promote schools, but their schools are the result of faithful preaching on a pulpit.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. From the beginning, yeah. That was understood. You heard that from Chatham. We were present, and I think I was in the board at that particular time. So the school is, and that's why we didn't send them either to the other Christian schools, the established ones.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, that the schools are a result of faithful preaching.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I know what you
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I believe that the...
It's on.
It's okay. That the church order was changed, because the original church talks about that the need to be assured that the schools be maintained. It didn't really specifically say elementary schools or high schools.
Right.
I think in those days, in 16, 18, 19, when the church order was put together, it had to do more with the theological education. Okay? But over the years, this has sort of evolved in that the elders do have a task to speak to the parents, but it is not, as was mentioned earlier, these are not church schools. These are parental schools.
That's right.
Totally separate from the church. Okay? Just wanted to make that clear.
Yeah, I would go a step further, actually, and say that they are community Christian schools in the sense that it's a church community that works together to support them. Right? So it's not, it is a parental Christian school, absolutely. But we can't forget that it's not just parents who work to support both financially and prayerfully these schools. It's a church community effort. And we'd be hard pressed to run these schools without that larger community effort.
That's why we call them covenantal, right?
I think the old church order article was that the church had to ensure that the teacher on the schools was a good church member.
Right.
The schools in those days were Christian schools because the country was.
Right, right. So the comment was that we have to remember that the schools in those days were Christian schools. The Lord's Prayer, they were Protestant schools. That's why we have a Catholic system, actually, because the public schools were considered to be Protestant schools. And then it shifted, right? It changed. And it changed because the purpose of the school was no longer to serve the honor and glory of the Lord, but it became to educate the children, and you get that whole idea of public funding. And that's something that is, I think, on the rise inside our own circles as well. There's a lot of questions nowadays about who goes or who is allowed to attend our schools. Should we open up enrollment to other church communities, to other church members? And that's the danger of building an excellent school. Your neighbors see the results of your work and how your work is reinforced like seamlessly in the school where your children go to, and they say, I want part of that. Can I come in? And how, when your neighbor says to you, I would love to send my child to your school, it is embarrassing, in a sense, to say, I'm sorry, it's not for you. It's for me. And so I've stopped answering the question like that. I actually promote open enrollment for schools. All you need to do, anybody can join. It starts with the church, though. So if you join our church, you're more than welcome to send your children to our schools. Because our churches are where we get the direction for what happens in our schools. Now, you also need to be careful, and I believe this too, maybe it's a little bit of an aside, but you have to be careful not to close your enrollment so far that you, as a board, lose all ability to be compassionate. And I think of an example that was very close to happening where the enrollment was, you know, members of the Canadian Reformed Churches can send their children to the school. And there's a family that was going through a very difficult situation where nobody was really sure whether or not both parents were going to remain in the church. But they still wanted their children to attend the school because their rationale for, or the reason why they were leaving the church was not because they disagreed with what was happening, but because their marital situation and their family situation warranted discipline. Now, the school board, in a sense, needs the leeway to say, if those parents wish to continue with this aspect, there could be, perhaps there should be, a way for them to do so. Because the board can be compassionate in those situations. So as soon as you close that door, then your ability to make those difficult choices is gone. But you have to do that carefully. And that's what their Human Rights Tribunal, I don't know if you followed that this past summer, with a community Christian school in the Sarnia Way. They had a lesbian couple wanted to enroll their child in preschool, and they said no, because our school is for people that subscribe to this creed, and one of the bits of the creed was that marriage was God ordained in between a man and a woman, so we're sorry you don't fit. And the couple took them to the Human Rights Tribunal, and the judge, or it's not really a judge, but the adjudicator of that tribunal decided in favor of the school for one reason. The school was consistent in their enrollment policy, and they had it all clearly spelt out, and they used it, and they used it well. So while I think we have to build that wiggle room inside our schools, because you don't know what the situations are going to be, you have to do that well. And I think the statements that we have, where we leave it up to the board's discretion, but we don't talk about what that discretion looks like, that's a challenge that we have to face perhaps going forward. When somebody wants to enroll and they say, look, you have this in your policy, you know, you can enroll due to, you know, if you want to, but you don't want to because I'm Hindu. That's discrimination. So the board needs to have that discretion kind of really well spelled out. So that was a bit of an aside, but it has to do with that purpose.
Yep.
Yeah, interesting that you were speaking about this, because this was one of the things that was in the invitation.
Yep.
You know, is it an outreach? Is it an evangelistic organization? And I'd say I would warn very strongly against that. I think there is a great danger. I think we've experienced this in North America. If you look at the Christian Reformed schools and what has happened and how this has deteriorated to a almost wide open enrollment, I've seen the same thing in our sister churches, still current sister churches, the Vrijgemaakte Kerken in Holland, the same way how they have allowed, at first it was only members of the church that could send their children, and I'm sure you have probably discussed this with your colleagues at your principals' meetings and so forth, you know, conferences. But this has now changed in our sister churches already in the Netherlands, where the school board will no longer require a membership in the Reformed Church, but they will send two people to these people's homes and ask about their faith life. And as long as they subscribe to Jesus Christ as the Son of God, and then they're okay to be enrolled. And of course, now you have all these influences coming into the school. There is a tendency to accommodate those other beliefs, if you want to call it that. We're now in Holland already too. It is no longer necessary to be a member of the liberated churches in order to teach in our schools. Okay? There's a wide open. Now in Holland, it appears a little bit different in that the government supports financially the schools. And so there is also a government pressure that we pay, so you need to open it up to others, where we don't have this. And I think we need to maintain a very closed structure. The schools is not an outreach project, and it is not a means to evangelize, you know, and I think we can say no. We've made some exceptions to other Reformed, United Reformed and Free Reformed, but I think we need to keep it very, very, very closed. Thank you.
Okay. And I don't disagree. And how do you do that? I think you have to, I think it's not, the danger, I guess, is not just from the outside, other churches, other denominations, other Christians coming in, changing the flavor of the school. I think that we have to be very clear, while our schools are in positions of strength, which I believe they are, that we define why we do it very clearly, and we make our decisions based on our purposes. right? And it's not just the overall purpose of to glorify God. While I think that I do, I honestly, I think it should be number one, top, right up on top. But the fact that you assist parents in their work, and you assist not just any parents, but parents of community-formed schools or, you know, something along those lines, it has to be clearly spelled out, clearly articulated, and you have to invite your young parents into the system so that they can let their voices be heard, right? But you have those core principles that you don't back down on. But how you work those out, I think you have to allow. Now, for those of you that remember, there's this report floating around called the Campin Report. It was a survey of the schools that took place, I want to say, in late 90s.
20 years ago, at least.
Yeah. And there's one piece. It was a great report, he'll tell you. But There's one piece that resonated with me, and that's that every generation of parents needs to re-articulate what a Christian school means to them. And I think that's how we keep it fresh, that's how we keep it current, and that's how we keep the current generations understanding the importance, the role of a Christian school to assist them in the academic education of their children.
Call it quits, or you got something yet?
No, I got lots, but you know.
You got lots?
I can keep talking. That's not an issue. Eh? I can keep talking. That's not an issue. But no, it's my wife says this enough.
Okay. Henry.
What's the psalm again?
Wait a minute. He's got something important.
Oh.
Yes, I just wondered, you started originally, the first question you provided to us was, what do you think should be the purpose of our schools? And you made with that the comment, so often we go to secondary things first, and that becomes the purpose of the school. And what would be your suggestion, your thought in what should be changed in what we have presently? And I think presently we have to assist the parents in the instruction of their children in the ways of the Lord, or biblically in the three confessions. Should we start with something very basic, for example? Just a thought on that. Or is that already incorporated into what we have?
So I think that every organization that's run by a Christian community should have an interstate battery type of purpose. That their main goal is to glorify God by doing whatever service they provide. So if I were to look at our schools, a lot of work has been done in mission and vision and those types of things, and that's all there. But what I would suggest is that we put that main purpose of man as the header. So in John Calvin's school, our purpose is to glorify God as we assist parents, and whatever the rest of the mission is, but to have it front and center. But I would say that if you have a mission for your farm, the main purpose here is to glorify God, and we milk cows. Right? It sounds funny, but that's if that becomes visible, if you were overt about that, I think it changes the way you do business. And it changes the way that people look at your business, because you everything you do is now weighed against that statement that we're here to glorify God, and we might make money, but that's not our main purpose.
Next time you walk in Guido, look on your right-hand side. What does it say there?
It says everything in Christ.
No.
No,
the other side.
The other side?
T- To the end that man may serve his God.
That's right.
That's why the school is there. So it's there.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. Yes.
Now I quit.
Psalm 78, verse 1 and 2.